Issues Etc. is underwritten in part by Concordia Publishing House, publishers of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, testing the claims of church growth. You can find information about this book on our website, issuesetc.org, and click the What's New section, or you can call Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month is testing the claims of church growth. 1-800-325-3040.
Today's conversation on Issues Etc. begins on the subject of just war in Iraq. We're going to be joined in just a moment by Michael Novak, and we're going to talk with him about just war doctrine and how it applies to the present situation with the U.S. and Iraq. After that, open lines for your questions and your comments. I will play for you the audio of a television commercial you may have seen. It's from an organization called Win Without War, and it is saying that for the U.S. to make war on Iraq would be to do something immoral, unjust, and unfair. And when we get to open lines, I'll take your questions and your comments, your reaction to our conversation with Michael Novak. Following that, we'll be talking with Pastor Bobby Brewer of Scottsdale Bible Church in Scottsdale, Arizona. Seven things you need to know about UFOs. And then in the third hour of the program, we'll be talking with Dr. Bob Weiss, Associate Professor of Practical Theology and Professor of Pastoral Ministry in the Life Sciences at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. He'll join us here in Studio A. If you've seen the cover of the latest Time magazine, you know what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about genetic science in the third hour of Issues Etc. today. Michael Novak holds the George Frederick Jewett Chair in Religion, Philosophy, and Public Policy for the American Enterprise Institute based in Washington, D.C. He's author of several books, including his latest, On Two Wings, Humble Faith and Common Sense at the American Founding. Professor Novak delivered a lecture this last Monday, an address, an essay, in Vatican City, titled Asymmetrical Warfare and Just War. Michael, welcome to Issues Etc.
Good to be with you, Todd. Good to be back with you.
What exactly were you doing in Vatican City on Monday?
Well, the lecture itself was not in Vatican City. Well, I gave the lecture twice, so that's fair. I gave a lecture on Saturday morning to the small group of staff at the Justice and Peace, the Department of Justice and Peace, which is, let's say, like a little like the Department of Human Rights at the Secretariat of State, a little bit broader than that, but it's a department of the Vatican government.
Now, I should point out that...
And then I gave a public lecture Monday night, which is the one that received the most attention, the same lecture, but to a bigger audience.
I should point out that while you are a prominent Roman Catholic thinker and writer, you did not go as an official representative of the State Department or the UN or anything like that, correct?
Oh, no. Both our embassies in Rome, the embassy to Italy and the embassy to the Vatican, have a joint lecture program, and it's an international program. They invite in people from many nations on a whole variety of issues, everything from agriculture to you know, just a whole range to the movies, to culture. And I have lectured in that program maybe six or seven times over the last 30 or 40 years. I go to Rome virtually twice a year for a lecture tour. And so I'm familiar with the program, and in fact, this is the second or third time I've been asked to speak to it in questions of just war, once in connection with Kosovo, once in connection with Afghanistan, and once now. So I got a call about a month ago asking, when am I coming to Europe next? Would I be free to give a lecture in the international series? Since I've done it before, since I love to go to Rome, I said sure, before I even knew the subject. And then you know, they told me the subject, and I said sure.
Now, do you consider yourself at odds with the Vatican on the issue of war with Iraq?
Not on the question of the principles invoked by the Vatican and by the long Catholic tradition from St. Augustine on this. No, I hold to all. I have been a proponent of all those principles for a long time and hold to them now. I think I do come down on a different practical assessment of the circumstances of how these principles apply and what the circumstances are in which they are applied at the present time. But as the Catechism of the Catholic Church points out, these are judgments for prudence, and the final judgment rests with the prudence of those charged with the common good of all, that is, the public authorities.
Michael, give us a rundown of those principles of just war that have been commonly recognized not only within the pale of the Roman Catholic Church, but in the history of the Church also in my wing in the Reformation. What are the basic principles? You mentioned Augustine, yeah, Aquinas as well.
Yeah, I should mention that so widespread are these, and with some roots in Aristotle, that the Muslims once shared them. That is, you find principles rather like these evoked in the medieval Muslim writings. So they're far beyond the Roman Catholic community alone. But they are these. They are two sets of questions. I need to step back once, Todd. Here's the point. Christians are bound by the gospel, and all of us are bound by the rules of reason in whatever field we're in, whether in private life, in dealing with our friends or with our families, or in public life. And St. Augustine was unusual in his thinking through of the role of the state. If you remember, after 410 AD, Rome had been sacked and the state had fallen apart. So he was trying to think through what is the role in this chaos of building states and what should Christians contribute their effort to. His view was that sin will always be present, always, and that and therefore statesmen, public authorities, will face a quite imperfect, even evil world, but they need to act well. They need to act in charity and in justice. So under charity and justice, he treated a method of moral reasoning for deciding questions ad bellum, what should you think about before you go to war, and then in bello, what questions should you think about when you're in a war? What's distinctive of moral behavior? And before you go to war, among the questions you have to face are, is there an act of aggression? Is this a war of self-defense? And not only self-defense, is there a smaller nation who's being treated so unjustly that a stronger nation is obliged to come to its aid? For Kosovo, the humanitarian intervention in Kosovo would have been a good example of that. And that, by the way, that's one which the Vatican supported as a just war. So that example goes all the way back to saying there are times when war is not forbidden, it's morally obligatory, when you have an obligation to do it. But when you say just, you don't mean permitted, you mean morally obligatory. And that's why the second condition comes up, but you're not morally obliged if it's impossible success. I mean, you don't have to commit suicide in a war. You have to have a reasonable prospect of success. And in modern times, we've added some conditions about the importance of working within the international structure of law. Augustine talked about this in terms of what is peace. Peace is the work of politics. It's executed by statesmen, by building the arrangements that lead to a cessation of hostilities, and by preventing hostilities. And this is mediated by law. Making peace is not a matter of sentiment or feeling. It's a matter of politics. It's a matter of the building of good political institutions. And so you need to attend to the institutions that are in play. You don't want to weaken those institutions. You want to strengthen those that protect human rights and the natural law, to put it in the old language, the laws of God. Then there are some in bello questions you need to face too. That is, you must protect civilians from harm. And this is built, by the way, this is for some time since World War II. This has been increasingly built into military doctrine and practice, at least in countries like our own. A NATO doctrine is, for example, you must never target civilians. If there are ever any civilians killed, it must always be by accident, not by deliberation. For instance, if you're bombing an airport, you must take care not to bomb the terminal where people gather. You must protect the people. Concentrate on the hangars and on the runways and on the repair shops, but not on where the people. Even the enemy barracks, you should not bomb the enemy barracks. You should not bomb p- people for the sake of people, even if they're military people. That's NATO doctrine today, at least so I'm informed. I was speaking to the general in the Italian army, and he was telling me how just war doctrine has penetrated the military doctrine of NATO these days. But that's a very important consideration. It's one reason why in Afghanistan we as much as possible avoided the cities, so that civilians would not normally be killed in our actions unless something went awry, you know, unless technology always fails in part. And there are other considerations like that. Make sure that the intervention does not cause more damage and more rupture in international relations than there would be before it. So the just war requires you to face a whole series of questions with an understanding of what the principles are and what exactly the questions are, and then to present your evidence for on one side or the other. And at each step, reasonable people may disagree that you're describing the circumstances exactly and realistically, but at least you have a framework for seeing where exactly the disagreement is, and you can offer evidence to show who's got the better picture. So it's a framework for coming to a reasonable conclusion among people of goodwill about what to do, yes or no.
So what was your conclusion, Michael? Almost all of the principles you have mentioned, especially the ad bellum principles before war, come into play in your argument in the lecture that you gave in Rome. What's your basic argument, and what do you contend about the just or unjust nature of the proposed war with Iraq?
First of all, anybody interested can find the full text of my argument, because I said nothing in private that I haven't said in public. The full text of my argument is available at nationalreview.com, National Review, all one word, .com, or at AEI.org, which reprinted that, my own organization, AEI, American Enterprise Institute, .org. And the argument goes exactly like this. Although some people in the administration have occasionally mentioned that it's a preventive war, that's being used as a military term like surprise action or something, not a just war term. And I don't think preventive war is yet a just war term. The reason we are going to go to war, unless Saddam Hussein argues, is that we are already in a war. And the war has not been concluded in the terms set by the United Nations in 1991. By the United Nations Security Council, first by the peace negotiations, then by the Security Council in Resolution 687, that Saddam Hussein committed two acts of aggression in 1991. One was the invasion of Iraq, but the other was the stockpiling of offensive weapons that only have an offensive purpose: chemical, biological warfare, and nuclear weapons. And they said he, as a condition of his remaining president, he must disarm, and he must prove that he disarmed. Now, we laid those conditions on South Africa. We laid those conditions, the UN, when I say we. The UN laid those conditions on Kazakhstan and other republics of the former Soviet Union, and it only took four or five verifiers, or a dozen verifiers or so, teams of them, to see that this was done, because the governments did it in good faith. They did it openly. They wanted it proved, so they welcomed the verifiers. The term inspectors is a misnomer. They're not inspecting for anything. They're there to make it easy for the government involved to prove what they've done and to witness it and to document it. And Saddam Hussein has never done that. In fact, seven times he said he has made a complete revelation, and the verifiers said, that's a lie. You haven't. It's not complete. It's not total. They did see to the destruction of a lot of weapons, though. He had a huge arsenal, and they did destroy a lot of them. You can read the reports of the verifiers. So they did a lot of good, but they were always worried about what happens to those other 5,000 liters of anthrax, for example. Now, less than a teaspoon of anthrax caused all kinds of turbulence, two deaths and hundreds of sicknesses here in Washington, D.C., closed the Hart office building, the Senate office building, for 2 months for decontamination. And so what would a liter do in Washington? It might kill, depending on how it was used, multiples of 10,000 people.
Perhaps at this point we should define that term that you use in the title of your lecture in Rome, asymmetrical warfare. Why is that important? What is it?
Well, it's a good place to do it because I'm just coming to that part in the argument. One of the wars in which we are now involved is the unfinished condition of the first war of 1991 with Iraq, namely they have not disarmed. As the Security Council noticed again this past October in Resolution 1441, unanimous vote. But the second reason we're concerned has to do with asymmetric warfare. September 11, 2001, the attack by Al-Qaeda on New York and Washington showed us something new, that there is now a hidden, clandestine, stateless delivery system for weapons of mass destruction, that little cells of two, three, and four people can become horrific engines of massive deaths if they're furnished with the deadly weapons. And we know that the Al-Qaeda operation is international. It's shot off weapons in Indonesia, in Pakistan, in Moscow. It blew up the opera house or caused the blowing up of the opera house and so on. Cells are being uncovered in Italy, Belgium, Spain, England, even as we speak. So suddenly the fact that Saddam Hussein had these aggressive weapons had a new threat. There is also now a delivery system to deliver them without any warning, without any massing of troops on the border in the normal way you used to see a war coming, with tanks moving to the front, moving up of petroleum and so forth as they get ready, just like we're getting ready on the borders of Iraq. It's going to be no surprise to them that we're there. All the signs have been visible for weeks. That's no longer the case with asymmetric warfare. And Osama bin Laden had the theory that you don't need a state to topple a state. You need a clandestine, highly disciplined, well-trained organization which can cause so much damage that citizens in established nations will give up hope that their government can protect them.
So what's the relationship between Osama bin Laden, who has obviously given us once and for all this and shown us what asymmetric warfare really looks like and how terrible it can be? What's the relationship between that and the proposed Iraqi action?
Well, the probability of the weapons of Iraq, which are nowhere been so prepared for offensive use and are nowhere exist in such stores as in Iraq, falling into the hands of or being placed deliberately in the hands in the bloodstream of Al-Qaeda or some other organization, or even in the hands of Iraqi cells operating, but that would be more dangerous because then it would have fingerprints on it, you could trace it. Is somewhere the probability of these two ingredients, the delivery system and the weapons getting together, is somewhere between 0 and 10. People who think there's no probability or very low probability say there's no need for concern. But the Prime Minister of Great Britain and of Italy and the majority of the Prime Ministers of Europe and the President of the United States have as their top political duty to provide the common defense, to protect the lives and the rights of their own populations. And they have to make a prudent person's calculation on how much risk they think their people can be subjected to. If you think the risk is only 15%, do remind yourself that that's almost enough for Russian roulette. In other words, one bullet out of six is about 16%. And can you play Russian roulette with the rights and life of your people? I don't think, and at least so far, a significant number of these prime ministers and presidents have announced they can't live with that, that the risk is higher than that, and it's too dangerous to allow these two ingredients to lie side by side. There are too many terrorist agencies, not just Al-Qaeda, and too much ill will and previously violent conduct by Saddam Hussein to believe that it's never going to happen. And so these two lines of warfare have suddenly become dangerously close. Reasonable people would disagree about how much the risk is, but after September 11th, a president of the United States has to calculate that if this danger exists and it were to materialize, he would forever be blamed if he did nothing about it, just as Clinton is being blamed.
One last question, Michael. What was the reaction to your lecture by Vatican officials and the others who heard it?
Well, I can speak more obviously of the reaction of the larger audience, because I, you know, had more time for conversations and feedback, and there were a lot more people there to get their view. And even from the Vatican, I think I could say this much. My job, as I saw it, as a Catholic and as an American citizen and public thinker, is not to persuade people. My job is to lay out a clear and convincing presentation of how I reason about these things. It's not exactly the way the administration, it doesn't depend on the concept of preventive war, for example, but it's my job to lay it out and to bring to their attention things they may or may not have thought of or put in this relationship. And I know for certain that because I did not depend on the concept of preventive war, which was widely advertised before I went there, they paid attention because they had not heard the other argument. I'm not going to say they agreed, but they know that there is a serious argument here. They might find lots of fault with it. We didn't have enough time to go on. Sometimes it takes a whole night of argument till you can find out exactly where you disagree. But we did not have time to do that. But at least there was a public presentation of a different argument. And it's a different way of looking at it from the way European press has been treating things for the last weeks.
Michael Novak, thank you very much for being our guest again. We appreciate your time.
Thanks a million, Todd. Best of luck to everybody.
Michael Novak holds the George Frederick Jewett Chair of Religion, Philosophy, and Public Policy for the American Enterprise Institute based in Washington, D.C. He's author of several books, including his latest, On Two Wings, Humble Faith and Common Sense at the American Founding. And he delivered this lecture this past Monday, in Vatican City and in Rome, called Asymmetrical Warfare and Just War. You can read it for yourself by going to nationalreview.com. That's nationalreview.com. You can also get it at the website aei.org. That's aei.org. We only have a few seconds here before we go to the bottom of the hour break. When we come back, we're going to have open lines for your questions and your comments. I do want to know what the rest of you think. What do you think about the war with Iraq? The big question looming now is not only when will we go, but there are still many asking, should we? And even if we're going to go, even if it is a foregone conclusion that we do go, and I think it's safe to say it is, barring any unforeseen action on the part of Saddam Hussein to suddenly either turn tail and run or turn everything over, do you have the same thoughts regarding the justice of this war? Do you agree with our guest, Michael Novak, or do you disagree? Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. What do you make of his argument, which is basically, now after September 11th, and in the world we live in today, we have two very volatile ingredients lying side by side in the hands of the world. One of these ingredients is international terrorism and the ability to wage asymmetrical warfare. The other ingredient lying right beside it is the capability and the will of Saddam Hussein, his technology and his war machine, whatever it may be, his ability to supply terrorists, and his desire, perhaps, to do so. Now, that's a volatile mix. And is it reasonable to think that no one will put the two together? We'll be right back. Stay with us.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Are marketing principles compatible with Christian evangelism? Can Christianity be marketed like Coca-Cola, Ford, or Chevy? And how much have business practices influenced the Christian church? You'll find answers to these questions with the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February, Testing the Claims of Church Growth. The book is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this book on our website, issuesetc.org, and click the What's New section, issuesetc.org. Testing the Claims of Church Growth is written by a former marketing executive and now pastor, Rod Zwanitzer. Testing the Claims of Church Growth, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040. That's 1-800-325-3040.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer in a 24-year-old man in India who accepted Jesus Christ, and then his family rejected him. His name is Vishnu, a Bible college student who was recently hospitalized with kidney problems. The ministry he works under is India Evangelical Mission, and they requested prayer because Vishnu's family refused to help him in any way. The medication he needed was quite expensive, but he couldn't ask his family to help cover any cost. Christians in India have to make tough choices if they decide to worship Jesus Christ as the Savior and reject the Hindu idols that their families worship. India Evangelical Mission also requests prayer for evangelists who travel within India to regions where cities, towns, and villages have no Christian witness. Learn more by calling 1-800-268-0461 and ask for the brochure To India with Love. That's 1-800-268-0461.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Right now, high-profile executives, government officials, and celebrities are being advised what they should or should not do. More than that, they have people deliberately keeping them out of the loop. People who think, I'll handle this one myself. And now that I think about it, it's not only high-profile people who have handlers. We all have people who think they know what's best for us. Are you a handler of God? Our fretting and worrying about what we should do is classic handling. No need to bother God with this. I'll take care of it myself. Theologians and religious people can be classic God handlers. Doctrinal pronouncements, even when true, can leave us imagining that we know our God to a T. The disciples tried to handle God. Mark 10 tells us people were bringing little children to Jesus to have him touch them, but the disciples rebuked them. When Jesus saw this, he was indignant. We all need trusted people to advise us, to help us take care of our business. Just don't become a handler of God. Let God handle you. I'm Dale Meyer.
Is your church sponsoring a spaghetti dinner or perhaps a sausage supper? Send us the information and we'll include it on our date book. We share various church activities daily at 8:30 in the morning and then again in the afternoon at 12:30 and 2:30 on the AM 850 KFUO date book. It's a service of AM 850 KFUO, inspirational Christian radio for St. Louis.
Welcome back. It's Open Lines, Issues, Etc. for the next 25 minutes. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Now, as usual, car phone callers, first-time callers, internet callers all get top priority. So get ready to call 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We're coming off a conversation with Michael Novak from the American Enterprise Institute. He was in Vatican City delivering a lecture about just war and Iraq. He said we do not have to modify just war theory in order to fit the war with Iraq in. It fits. Two arguments he has made. One, this is simply a continuation of the 1991 war. There's just been a 12-year hiatus. What do you think of that? Number two, we have two volatile ingredients laying side by side, and any reasonable person should expect that sooner or later international terrorism and the capabilities of Saddam Hussein will come together in a volatile mix. Oh, and speaking of war with Iraq, have you seen this commercial on TV?
If we invade Iraq, There's a United Nations estimate that says there will be up to 500,000 people killed or wounded. Do we have the right to do that to a country that's done nothing to us?
No nation under God has that right. It violates international law. It violates God's law. War only creates more terrorists and makes a dangerous world for our children.
Now, that's a television commercial that's sponsored by a group called Win Without War. The male voice on the commercial was United Methodist Bishop Melvin Talbert. In fact, on the video of the commercial, he is identified as the president of President Bush's church. That is the United Methodist Church. He's actually the presiding bishop there. What do you think about this commercial? The first voice was Janine Garofalo. She's a Hollywood starlet. And she says no country has the right to make war on Iraq the way we are getting ready to make war on Iraq. What do you think? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Have you seen the commercial? Did it score any points with you? Now, wherever you stand on this issue, you should know who's behind the Win Without War campaign, advocating alternatives to preemptive war against Iraq, keep America safe. Now, this is interesting. They're framing the argument in terms of preemptive war, and I think I've been guilty of referring to this as a preemptive war as well. I don't know whether or not Michael Novak was able to make the case. What do you think? That this isn't preemptive war. This is the continuation of a war started 12 years ago. A ceasefire was called because Saddam Hussein agreed that he would disarm. He hasn't, and the war goes on. Here's some of the people behind Win Without War and the commercial we just played for you. Among others, the National Council of Churches, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, Greenpeace, the NAACP, the National Council of Churches, of course, is there, the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, National Organization of Women, a group called Pax Christi, which is a Roman Catholic peace group, Pax Christi USA, the Rainbow Push Coalition, what else here? The Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations and the United Methodist Church General Board and Church of Church and Society, of course, because their presiding bishop is in the commercial himself. I wonder whether or not these groups really have the moral fiber, whether or not that they have the moral credibility to be able to say whether war with Iraq is moral, fair, or just. What do you think? I mean, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, since when has morality been a problem for them? The immorality of anything. We're talking about a church that will, very soon, be ordaining active lesbians and homosexuals. In fact, it's already happened. They're having a little spat about it. Greenpeace has connections to ecological terrorism, of course. Themselves, the National Council of Churches, all these groups, by the way, as far as I can tell, are avid supporters of abortion. No question about the justice of that particular action. What do you think? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. And for those of you who didn't get to hear the commercial in a few minutes, we'll play it again for you so you can hear the basic gist. No country has the right to make war on Iraq the way we're going to make war with Iraq. What do you think about that? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Just a reminder, for those of you tuning in the next hour after we're done with open lines here in about 20 minutes, Pastor Bobby Brewer, pastor at Scottsdale Bible Church in Arizona, and author of the book Postmodernism, What You Should Know and Do About It, we'll talk about seven things that you should know about UFOs. And then in the third hour of the program, joining us here in Studio A, Dr. Bob Weiss, Associate Professor of Practical Theology and Professor of Pastoral Ministry and the Life Sciences, that's a long title, at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. We're going to talk about genetic science in light of the cover story of Time magazine on genetic science. Did you see Dear Abby? Good old Dear Abby and her advice. Is she still alive, or are they just like rehashing these things? She looks alive. Of course, pictures can be deceiving. Maybe you saw this a couple days ago. Religious message in holiday treats can be politely refused. What she's got there is actually a series of letters that she received and answered, and it begins with someone taking issue with the way she responded to a letter. Dear Abby, your advice to happy Hindu in the Bible Belt, and we'll get to that letter in just a second, whose Christian friends tuck religious pamphlets into holiday boxes of baked goodies in an effort to convert her, was off base. You advised her to ignore the brochures and enjoy the goodies, unless she had lost her appetite, in which case she could donate the treats to a shelter or take them to the office. I disagree. That lovely lady should politely tell her friends that she likes her own religion and ask them to please stop with the religious literature. If they continue, she should end the friendship. If converting her is more important than her friendship, there is no friendship. And then that's signed Ben There in Bend, Oregon. Dear Abby writes back, your answer is better than mine. Interestingly, Happy Hindu's problem appears to be widespread. That letter brought a bushel of mail. Read on. Here's another one. Dear Abby, I am Jewish. A friend from college kept sending me Jesus Loves You Christmas cards. I told her it hurt my feelings that she didn't respect my beliefs. I made it clear that I am Jewish and I will always remain Jewish, as it is my religious and cultural background. Like Hindu, I know that some of these gestures are well-intentioned, but I would never dream of sending my friend Hanukkah cards. I send cards that say season's greetings or happy holidays. It's good to learn about other people's beliefs and be open to them, but not when they're focused on you or forced on you. That's Jill in Sacramento. Abby responds, I regret that I did not advise Happy Hindu to be as outspoken and upfront as you and been there. One more letter from Mary in Alluye, Georgia. Your answer to Happy Hindu offended me as a Christian. Oh, my goodness. This kind of stuff just, nothing gets under my skin than Christians that are just stand around waiting to get offended. We can chuckle at this stuff, folks. Your answer to Happy Hindu offended me as a Christian. If the circumstances were different, would you tell me to ignore my Buddhist friends but eat their treats if I didn't gag first? Why is evangelical Christianity the only religion we shouldn't tolerate? And this is what Abby has to say in response. Anyone who proselytizes is treading on sacred ground. It's regarded as offensive, even if it's heartfelt. I think they're both wrong, actually. I think the offended Christian in Georgia is as wrong as Dear Abby is. This is not an issue of toleration. This is an issue of proselytization. Abby did not argue that this woman's evangelical Christianity should not be tolerated. In fact, she was arguing that it be tolerated. Disagree with it, disregard it, which is what toleration is. You disagree with something, you disregard it, you let it go. Someone else is going to hold a different belief. You know they're wrong. You will not go out and kill them. You will not seek to have them thrown in jail. That's called toleration. The good old American way. And by the way, I think toleration might also extend to proselytization. Isn't this what you do when the Mormon comes to your door? You tolerate the Mormon. The Mormon comes to your door. They say, can I have 5 minutes of your time? You say yes. You listen patiently. And maybe you say something if you have the presence of mind to do it, like, I am a Christian. I believe that your adherence to the Book of Mormon and to Joseph Smith and his myths and lies are false. Can I have 5 minutes of your time to talk to you about Jesus? And you do. That's called toleration. And you know what? It includes him proselytizing you and you proselytizing him. And you have both tolerated and you have both proselytized. The difference is, the word about Jesus you speak has power to convert hearts. The word about Joseph Smith that he speaks to you are just words. You have the distinct advantage. That's why you can tolerate it. That's why you can listen patiently to the Mormon, because they're just words. You have something far better. You have the gospel. Now, what do you think? Would you be sending Jesus Loves You Christmas cards to a Hindu friend or to a Jewish friend? Lay aside the fact that for some reason this Jew seems to find Jesus' love for her offensive and gets her feelings hurt because Jesus loves her. But do you think that's just bad form? The phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Oh, I've got a little update on the Estrada filibuster as well. If I have time, I will get to it. For those who are just tuning in, let's listen again to this commercial that was sponsored by that organization called Win Without War.
If we invade Iraq, there's a United Nations estimate that says there will be up to 500,000 people killed or wounded. Do we have the right to do that to a country that's done nothing to us?
No nation under God has that right. It violates international law. It violates God's law. War only creates more terrorists and makes a dangerous world for our children.
Now, whether or not you've seen the commercial, you heard it. Do you agree or disagree? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. The question was posed, do we have the right, do we Americans have the right to make war on Iraq when they've done nothing to us? Do you buy it? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's open lines, issues, etc. I must say, I've been thinking a lot about the just war framework and war with Iraq. I've been thinking a lot about it. Even given what I know about just war, there were a couple things in that conversation with Michael Novak in the last half hour that were like little Christmas lights going on in my head. In particular, his line of argumentation that we are really simply seeking to continue to finish what was started in 1991. Now, that might sound trite to some people. Let's finish what we started. But his argument seemed rather cogent to me. The only reason the war in 1991 came to a ceasefire was because Saddam Hussein, in essence, said, I want a ceasefire, and here are my terms. I will disarm. Now, had he not disarmed and not allowed inspections in 1992, we would have gone back, right? Or at least we should have gone back to finish what we started. Does the fact that it's been 12 years between his promise to disarm and now, does it mean that we're not continuing the same war? Stan is calling from his car. Stan, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yeah, Pastor, well, he didn't say when he disarmed, you know.
We just lost Stan. He got in about three words. If you want to call back, Stan, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. So we have a continuation of a previous war. That's arguable. Okay, I understand that. It's intriguing, though. But he made more carefully the argument that I think the Bush administration has been making in a more clumsy way. Even someone like Colin Powell, that we have these two things, two volatile ingredients that by themselves are dangerous, but not imminently dangerous. Iraq and their capability of delivering weapons of mass destruction, which they produce. And on the other hand, the other ingredient, international terrorism, asymmetrical warfare. By themselves, either of these ingredients is not imminently dangerous. Well, terrorism always is. But put them together, and the danger factor, increases exponentially. If a terrorist is given the means by which to deliver, or giving the substance to deliver themselves. Remember how they delivered death a year and a half ago? They used our own planes. If they wanted to deliver death by means of biological or chemical warfare, they wouldn't need to find a missile. They're not afraid to die. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Yesterday, during open lines, I had talked a little bit about the Estrada filibuster that's going on today in the Senate. I read on crosswalk.com, a number of groups are calling for, these are mostly conservative Christian groups, are calling for the citizens to do just about everything they can possibly do to stop this filibuster. They're calling for grassroots efforts. This is what it says. A grassroots effort is needed to help in the battle over federal judicial nominees, most immediately Miguel Estrada. A president's judicial appointment are a legacy that lasts well beyond the president's term in office, and the decision those judges make significantly impact our culture. This is why it is so important for our readers to have their voice heard on the upcoming confirmation votes. Here's how you can help. They give out the numbers of the various senators, the various people who have been standing against the nomination, some people who are on the line. They have quotes from the Concerned Women for America and various other groups, all of them decrying the filibuster, which raises the question I raised yesterday. Is this something we should be decrying, or we should say this is the way the Senate works? And if we were in the other position, if the shoe was on the other foot, we would expect everyone to do the same thing. They do have quotations from various Democratic senators who back in 1998 were insisting that every nominee is entitled to an up or down vote. And they make the point, of course, that some of those same senators will not allow an up or down vote on Miguel Estrada. I don't know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander as far as I'm concerned. It's about time we had a good old-fashioned filibuster. I always wonder what one of those looked like. I always pictured a lot of guys standing around in top hats with cigars sticking out of their mouths. Smoke-filled rooms, things like that. It's really much more boring than that. Now, whether or not it'll be able to defeat the nomination, that's another question. You may not have heard this, but Pat Robertson has prostate cancer. This was announced in the Associated Press today. Religious broadcaster Pat Robertson said Thursday he has prostate cancer and will undergo surgery to remove the gland. The cancer does not appear to have spread beyond the prostate, according to a news release from his Christian Broadcasting Network. The surgery is scheduled for Monday. His release date, the release said that his doctors anticipate that Robertson, 72, will return to a full schedule within 2 weeks. Now, it's very true that prostate cancer, if caught early, is one of the most curable forms of cancer. And the surgery in this case is the way they deal with it. Wasn't one of the Democratic presidential candidates just went under the knife this weekend or this week for the same thing, John Kerry? Won't hurt his chances. We have Stan back calling from his car. Stan, welcome to Issues, Etc. All right, we'll try it again. Oh, by the way, folks, part of the reason we're a little touchy on the phones, this is the first day we've had both phones back all week, too. But it's supposed to be working now. It's supposed to be working. We think we have both phones back. We yet to have any proof of that, don't we? Well, I am no great fan of Pat Robertson, but please keep him in your prayers. I mean, even at 72, you do not want the man to have any more serious problems than just surgery for prostate cancer. According to George Barna, evangelicals are ready to re-elect Bush, but other Americans aren't so sure. Nearly 6 out of 10 adults, that is 57%, say that the president is doing, quote, an excellent job of leading the country, while one-third, that is 36%, disagree with that perspective. Surprisingly, few people have no opinion on the matter, indicating that Americans are quite engaged in monitoring the president's performance in office. Three particular population groups emerged as those likely to affirm the excellence of President Bush's leadership. 4 out of 5 people from each segment agreed that Mr. Bush is doing an excellent job. The segments are evangelicals at 82%, excellent job. Republicans, 84%, excellent job. And conservatives, 79%. They're a little more wishy-washy. Other groups were more likely than the norm to give the president positive evaluations, including people who were actively involved in their faith, whites, married people, residents of the western and southern states, and those who are upscale. Whatever that means. Oh, that's an income exceeding $60,000 a year. 4 segments stood out as having the least regard for the job performance of the president. Those groups included African Americans, 52% of whom disagreed that he is doing an excellent job. But I wonder what happens if you're an African American evangelical Republican. He doesn't cover that. Atheists and agnostics at 43% say that he is doing a poor job, and of course Democrats at 43% as well, and those who called themselves liberals. But by and large, says Barna, by and large, Americans like the president. And he is a likable guy. There's no doubt about that. There's not a lot about him not to like. I wonder, we get these kind of unbelievable poll ratings from evangelicals on the president. 82% of evangelicals can agree that the president is doing an excellent job. I do wonder whether we could get 82% of evangelicals to agree on, well, what? How a person is saved? How many of them would agree that it is by grace through faith for the sake of Christ alone? Which is supposed to be what makes them evangelicals in the first place. Which would draw me to conclude that they are more pro-Bush than they are evangelical. Or maybe what defines an evangelical now is simply voting Republican with a conservative social agenda, and less about the gospel. I will tell you that on Judgment Day, God will not be inquiring as to how you polled on George Bush's job performance. He will be deeply concerned about who you say Jesus Christ is. Maybe part of the reason for that, maybe part of the reason that people can easily confuse their evangelicalism, their centeredness on the gospel, with just simply being a loyal George Bush guy, is because the gospel is so rare, even in the churches. Put into the background. Oh yeah, it's kind of the background music that we always have there, but it never comes out prominently for anyone to hear. Maybe it's something that is forestalled. We'll tell you about Jesus after we have shown you all the benefits of being a Christian. What a moral life you can lead, and how much better your marriage and your finances, your family and your business will be when you become a Christian. First, let's tell you about the benefits of being a Christian, and then later, perhaps much later, we'll tell you about what being a Christian is. Putting the cart before the horse. It's one of the basic principles of the church growth movement, sad to say, at least as it's manifesting itself now. That's why we have as our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, a book called Testing the Claims of Church Growth by Pastor Rod Zwanitzer. You need this book, folks. Order Testing the Claims of Church Growth by calling Concordia Publishing House in the next hour. 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. The book only costs $16.99. You can also order it online any time of day or night. Go to our Issues Etc. website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you're going to find ordering information on our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, Testing the Claims of Church Growth. You can call one more hour or go online. The toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040. Or go to our Issues Etc. website, and you'll find a link there to Concordia Publishing House, where you can order Testing the Claims of Church Growth. Now, when we come back from this break, we're going to talk about seven things you need to know about UFOs.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.